We call this part of the Old Mole Another World is Possible. AWP is a concept that goes back to antiquity. When Plato wrote The Republic, for instance, he was attempting to persuade his readers and fellow citizens that a society starkly different from the one they lived in was conceivable. At the level of practice, and even earlier, organized groups encountering other organized groups would have been aware that not all people constructed their societies the same, that a whole range of authority structures, of political and economic coordination, was possible. David Graeber and David Wengrow make that point in their recent book, The Dawn of Everything, and Kim Stanley Robinson has a contemporary novel, Shaman, that's partly about those early encounters and that recognition of alternatives. So much for the concept of AWP. As a slogan, Another World is Possible is associated with the World Social Forum, international meetings that began early this century to oppose the kind of globalization forced on us by neoliberal capitalism. One of the key inspirations for those meetings, and a group often associated with the slogan, is the Zapatista Army for National Liberation, the EZLN, the Zapatistas of Southern Mexico. We haven't heard much recently about the Zapatistas, but they've been active, and the semi-autonomous region they coordinate continues to grow. Notice my careful attempt at phrasing, because it's not easy to characterize the kind of society they're attempting to create and their role in it. I said semi-autonomous, where they say autonomous, because they're still part of and surrounded by conventional Mexico. I said coordinate, but perhaps facilitate would be better. Their model of revolution is different from others we've seen. A remarkable new book, Zapatista Stories for Dreaming an Other World, not another world, but an other world, has just come out from PM Press that approaches these questions through some of the parables the Zapatistas use in their organizing. With the aid of a couple of wonderful actors, I want to present two of the parables to you. But first, some background. Emiliano Zapata, you'll remember, was one of the great leaders in the early stage of the Mexican Revolution. The way he envisioned the possibility of another world was through land redistribution to the peasantry. Assassinated in 1919, his image and slogan, Tierra y Libertad, land and freedom, can still be seen on walls throughout southern Mexico, still an inspiration as conditions for people worsen through that neoliberal capitalist version of globalization. In various ways, the struggle he led has continued through to the present, signified by the EZLN, incorporating his name in theirs. In an earlier episode of Another World is Possible, I focused on sociolinguistics, the different understandings of the world and its possibilities that are both built into and limited by the structure of our various languages. I talked there about my experience with an indigenous group in southern Mexico and how their life and language is conducive to a particularly democratic and ecological vision of revolution. That group, the Tojolabales, is one of seven communities, maybe nations, each consisting of many villages that constitute the Zapatista movement. You can find that episode on the Old Mole website as part of the program for September 15th, 2021. Land redistribution and the rebuilding of ejidos, the communal ownership of land, was one of the legacies of the Mexican Revolution. Then, along came NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement of 1994. You may know of NAFTA from the standpoint of the United States, particularly the way it encouraged the loss of manufacturing jobs here and the flight of industry to cheaper labor in Mexico. But NAFTA has been equally hard, if not harder, on a huge part of the Mexican population. One of the preconditions of the treaty, one of the things the Mexican government had to agree to ahead of time, was the end of land redistribution and the disbanding of all ejidos. In other words, no communal land ownership, everything individually owned and available to the market. NAFTA went into effect on January 1, 1994. On that same day, the EZLN launched its revolution throughout the state of Chiapas. Here's what one of its leaders said.
In this war of conquest, everything and all of us are subjected to the criterion of the market. Anything that opposes it or presents an obstacle will be eliminated. It implies the destruction of humanity as a socio-cultural collective and reconstructs it as a marketplace. Opposing neoliberalism, fighting against it, is not just one political or ideological option. It is a question of the survival of humanity.
The person who wrote those lines called himself Marcos. You may remember him from the iconic image, wearing a balaclava, smoking a pipe. The stories we'll present today are attributed to him. They're part of organizing efforts, building confidence and capabilities within the EZLN communities, reaching out, incorporating new communities, and expanding the EZLN territory, creating new ejidos, even in the face of government repression. The stories are playful and humorous, but also deadly serious. These are stories of a people embattled. The Zapatistas call their struggle una guerra contra el olvido, a war against oblivion. In both these stories, you'll notice something unusual for us. People smoke. That pipe of Marcos isn't just a personal vice. Among the Mayans, smoke signifies words, signifies conversation, resolving problems together through discussion. In the ancient hieroglyphics, those that survive after all the destruction by the European colonizers, speech is represented by smoke curling from the speaker's mouths. The first of our stories is told with the assistance of 11-year-old Liv Lyra Kohlberg, making her radio debut, playing a glasses-wearing, pipe-smoking, scholarly little beetle. Our disclaimer? No tobacco was actually consumed in the course of her performance. Dorito's story. Let me tell you a story about something that happened to me the other day. It's the story of a little beetle who wears glasses and smokes a pipe. I met him one day when I was looking for my tobacco and couldn't find it. All of a sudden, I saw to the side of my hammock that a little tobacco had fallen and was forming a thin trail. I followed it to figure out where my tobacco had gone and who the hell had taken it and was spilling it. A few meters away, behind a rock, I found a beetle sitting at a little desk, reading some papers and smoking a tiny pipe. Ahem, ahem, I said, so that the beetle would take note of my presence. But he paid no attention. So I said to him, "Hey, that tobacco is mine." The beetle took off his glasses, looked me over from top to bottom, and said very angrily,
"Please, Captain, I beg you not to interrupt me. Can't you see I'm studying?"
I was taken aback and was going to kick him out of the way, but then I calmed down and sat nearby to wait until he finished studying. After a while, he gathered his papers, put them away in his desk, and chewing his pipe, he said,
"Very well, then. How can I be of service to you, Captain?"
"My tobacco," I answered.
"Your tobacco? Would you like some?"
I started to get angry, but the little beetle passed me the bag of tobacco with his tiny leg as he added,
"Don't get angry, Captain. You need to understand that it is impossible to get tobacco around here, and I had to take some of yours."
I calmed down. I was beginning to like the beetle, so I told him, "Don't worry. I have more back there," he answered. "What is your name, sir?" I asked him.
"Nebuchadnezzar, but my friends call me Dorito. You may call me Dorito, Captain."
I thanked him for the honor and asked him what it was that he was studying.
"I am studying neoliberalism and its strategy to dominate Latin America,"
he answered. "What use is that to a beetle?" I asked him. He responded very angrily,
"What do you mean? What use? I have to know how long this fight of yours is going to last, and whether or not you are going to win. Besides, a beetle should care enough to study the situation of the own world he lives in. Don't you agree, Captain?"
"I don't know," I said. "Why do you want to know how long our fight is going to last, and whether we're going to win or not?"
"Clearly, you haven't understood a thing,"
he replied, putting on his glasses and lighting his pipe. After blowing a mouthful of smoke, he continued,
"It's in order to know how long we beetles need to be on the lookout so that you don't squash us under your enormous boots."
"Ah," I said.
"Hmm,"
he said. "And what conclusion have you reached in your study?" I asked him. He took his papers from his desk and began leafing through them.
Hmm,
he said every so often as he looked them over. When he had finished, he looked me in the eye and said,
"You are going to win."
"I already knew that," I said, and I added, "But how long is it going to take?"
"A long time,"
he told me, sighing with resignation. I knew that too already. "You don't know exactly how long, do you?" I asked.
"One cannot know exactly. One has to take into account many things. The objective conditions, the maturity of subjective conditions, the correlation of forces, the crisis of imperialism, the crisis of socialism, etc., etc."
I said.
"What are you thinking about, Captain?"
"Nothing," I answered. "Very well, Señor Dorito. I have to go. It was a pleasure meeting you. Please feel free to take as much tobacco as you want, whenever you want."
"Thank you, Captain. And there is no need to call me Señor."
"Thank you, Dorito. I will tell my troops that from now on, it is forbidden to step on beetles. I hope that helps."
"Thank you, Captain. That will be very helpful."
"In any case, you should still be careful, because my men are very absent-minded, and they don't always pay attention to where they put their feet."
"Understood, Captain."
"See you soon."
"See you. Come whenever you want and we can talk."
"I'll do that," I said, and returned to headquarters. That was Liv Lyra Kullberg with me, Norm Diamond, on KBOO Portland. So, how long will the struggle take? We can't know. What we can know, what we, the communities in struggle, must know, is that ultimately we will win. In the near term, however, there is the danger of being crushed, not only by heavy boots, but by the new world order of market relations and capitalism. But what is it we're up against, and how will we win? The second story approaches those questions at a profound level. Notice, of course, the reference to old moles. Well, to moles, anyway, young or old. Old Antonio, played in this story by honorary old mole Diane Hess, is based on a real person, a member of one of the indigenous communities who counseled and guided the Zapatistas in their formative years. The lion kills by looking. Old Antonio hunted a mountain lion with his ancient shotgun. I had made fun of his weapon just days before. They were using weapons like that when Hernan Cortes conquered Mexico, I had said to him. He defended himself.
"Sure, but look who's wielding it now."
Now he is taking the last shreds of flesh from the hide to tan it. He proudly shows me the hide. It doesn't have a single hole in it.
right in the eye. That's the only way to keep the hide intact.
What are you going to do with it? I ask. Old Antonio does not answer. He continues scraping the hide with his machete in silence. I sit down next to him, and after filling my pipe, attempt to roll him a corn husk cigarette. I silently offer it to him. He examines it and takes it apart.
You're not there yet,
he tells me as he re-rolls it. We sit down and begin the ceremony of smoking together. Between puffs, old Antonio spins the story.
The lion is strong because the other animals are weak. The lion eats their flesh because they allow him to eat it. The lion doesn't kill with his claws or fangs. The lion kills by looking. First, he approaches slowly, in silence, because he has clouds on his paws that dampen the noise. Next, he pounces and with a swipe takes his victim down, more by surprise than by force. And after that, he just stares at his prey. The lion looks at his prey like this.
Old Antonio furrows his brow and fixes his black eyes on me.
The poor little animal who is going to die just stares. All it can do is look at the lion looking at it. The little animal no longer sees itself. It sees what the lion sees. It sees the image of a little animal, and in that gaze, it is small and weak. Before this, the little animal has never thought about whether it was small or weak. It was just a little animal, neither big nor small, neither strong nor weak. But now, seeing itself in the eyes of the lion, it sees fear. And seeing how it appears to the lion, the little animal all on its own, convinces itself that it is small and weak. And seeing the fear that the lion sees, it is afraid. And the little animal stops looking at anything, and its bones become numb, like when we get caught in the rain, in the mountains, in the night, in the cold. And the little animal surrenders, gives up. And the lion gobbles it down just like that. This is how the lion kills. He kills by looking. But there is one little animal that doesn't respond in this way. When he comes across the lion, he ignores him and continues as usual. If the lion swipes at him, he answers by clawing with his hands, which may be tiny, but the blood they draw certainly hurts. This little animal does not back down because he does not see the lion staring at him. He's blind. Mole is what they call this little animal.
Old Antonio seems to have finished talking. I venture a yes, but old Antonio doesn't let me finish and continues telling the story while he rolls another cigarette. He does it slowly, turning to look at me every so often to make sure I am still paying attention.
Mole went blind because instead of looking outward, he began to look into his heart. He insisted on looking inward. No one knows how this idea of looking inward got into the mole's head. The mole was so stubborn about looking into his heart that he didn't worry about things like strong or weak, big or small, because the heart is the heart. And it isn't measured the way things and animals are. However, It so happens that only the gods were permitted to look inward. So they punished the mole, and they didn't allow him to look outward anymore. Even worse, they condemned him to live and crawl under the earth. And that's why the mole lives underground, because the gods punished him. But the mole wasn't even upset, since he continued looking inward. That's why the mole is not afraid of the lion. And neither is the man who knows how to look into his heart. Because the man who knows how to look into his heart does not see the strength of the lion. What he sees is the strength of his heart. And then he looks at the lion, who sees the man looking at him. There in the man's gaze, the lion sees that he is a mere lion and sees himself being stared at. And he is afraid and runs away.
So did you look into your heart to kill this lion? I interrupt.
Me? No way. I concentrated on where the gun was aimed and where the lion's eye was and fired. Just like that. My heart didn't even cross my mind.
I scratch my head the way they do around here whenever they don't understand something. Old Antonio stands up slowly. He takes the hide and examines it carefully. Then he rolls it up and hands it to me.
Take it. It's for you. So you never forget that the lion and fear are both killed by knowing where to look.
Old Antonio turns around and goes inside his home. In old Antonio's language, that means, I'm done. Adios. I put the hide of the lion in my nylon bag and leave. Stories exist in contexts, and words have meanings in particular contexts. Moles are a common way to refer to comrades among the Zapatistas, as in addressing someone as Hermano Topo, Brother Mole. Looking inward is also a common phrasing, referring not to individual contemplation, but rather to finding answers within a shared culture that's under attack. Going back to our true heart has a more concrete meaning than might appear to us. The true heart is the community assembly I described in that earlier radio piece on sociolinguistics. This is a story about resisting hegemony, about not giving in to the seeming power of the state and dominant culture, about drawing on the strength of one's own community, culture, and organizing. The gods in this culture are not all-knowing, all-powerful. They too have assemblies, confer with each other, and change their minds. As to the lion, here's what Joanne Wypijewski says in her lyrical and insightful foreword.
The ferocious animal is enlisted in parables not to inflate danger, which only reinforces the eternal victim, but to encourage us to take a true measure of it and of our own powers. The lowliest creature teaches the necessity of reason and its attributes. Humans must observe, listen, assess, come to an understanding, and be able to laugh at themselves. Fearlessness is not part of the sequence. Humanity is not fearless. It is aware.
I'll conclude with one more story. This one, not a parable, but an account of a true event. I mentioned that old Antonio was a real person. At a crucial time in the early organizing, he waited with Marcos outside the meeting place where his own community was deciding whether to join the projected uprising. Probably they smoked, and Antonio taught Marcos more about their language and culture. Finally, the assembly ended, and Antonio's son brought them the result. of the deliberation. Here's what it said. The men, women, and children assembled at the school in the community to see in our hearts if it was time to begin the war for freedom. We split into three groups to debate: women, children, and men. After that, we all came back together in the schoolhouse, and the majority reached the conclusion that the war had to begin, because Mexico was already selling itself off to foreigners, and while hunger may come and go, if we are no longer Mexicans, that will be forever. This agreement was reached by 12 men, 23 women, and 8 children capable of reasoning, and was signed by all those who knew how. Those who didn't, signed with their thumbprint. I'm tempted to say that the rest is history, except the history continues. The EZLN is held out against army and paramilitaries. They're building schools, clinics, and further communal land ownership. They've been and continue to be a catalyst for groups around the world aiming at social change. I've been talking about and drawing on Zapatista stories for dreaming an other world, translated and with very interesting commentaries by an ad hoc group, the Colectivo Relámpago, the Lightning Collective, with a foreword by Joanne Wipajewski. For the Old Mole, this has been Norm Diamond, accompanied by Liv Lyra Kohlberg, Diane Hess, and Patricia Kohlberg.